It's good to see you this morning. I'm glad you're here. We're studying this morning from Acts chapter 27, so if you would open your Bibles to that text, we'll continue. We're talking about the travels of Paul to Rome, and as we continue that portion of our study, we'll notice some of the places that he went and why, circumstances involved in some of those things. So, in our study this morning, we're talking about the apostles' travel to Rome in 27 and 28 of the book of Acts. We have noted in our previous studies that the Apostle Paul was arrested in the city of Jerusalem in Acts chapter 21. We know that he was rescued essentially from the mob in chapter 22 and made his defense to the Jewish people. And then in chapter 23, he is taken by the proconsul Jewish court, the Sanhedrin court, where he makes his defense in chapter 23, verse 1, identifying that he had lived before God in all good conscience until this day. In Acts 24, he then makes his defense before Felix, and we've talked about the corrupt politician that Felix was, and then how that he left Paul in prison for his successor, Festus, in Acts chapter 25. In chapter 26, he appears before King Agrippa, who has assisted Festus in the preparing of a letter to send Paul to Rome, where he has made his appeal to appear before Caesar. And now we are in chapter 27, where he is journeying to Rome in the events, treacherous events, that he embarks upon on that journey. Now, in our study last time, we identified some of these places. We talked about how that he left Caesarea, where he'd been in prison for a period of time, and then journeyed northward to Sidon, where he was permitted leave to go and refresh himself with his friends by the centurion Julius. And then as he travels northward, he noted that he went north of Cyprus, protected by from the winds, as we discussed in our last study, and then came over to Myra, and then they set forth along the coast on their way to the leeward side of Crete. Now, we noted in our last study that they arrived at a place called Fair Havens, and this discussion takes place, as we noted in the text, between the Apostle Paul and the Julius, the chief centurion named Julius is responsible for the prisoners. And the shipmaster and the owner to stay in Fair Havens or to proceed farther. Paul points out you need to stay here. Now, we've noted in the previous studies that Paul is well familiar with travel on the Mediterranean Sea, well familiar with the possibility and even the experience of a shipwreck on the Mediterranean Sea. We've noted that he wrote the book of 2 Corinthians, where he identifies some of his perils, including a shipwreck, night and the day, he said he'd been in the deep. So he was well experienced with travel in this area. And we've also noted that this particular time of the year, in verse 9, voyage on the Mediterranean Sea was expressly dangerous because of the winds. And the time of the year is identified. The feast had already gone by, and we noted that the feast that's being alluded to in this passage is what? What feast was it? The Day of Atonement, yes, the Day of Atonement. And we know that that was September, October period of time, and my understanding is that after November began, particularly some sources said November the 11th, I don't know why that particular date, but after that, the Mediterranean Sea, for the most part, was just closed. They didn't travel during that period of time because the travel was so treacherous. But that tells us the time of year that Paul was traveling on this and the knowledge that he had. Of course, the centurion was listening to the shipmaster and the owner and determined that they would go on forward from Fair Havens to this place called Phoenix over on the end of the Isle of Crete. And there was a better place, they thought, to winter there. And Paul's advice was, do not do that. because if you do, there will be certainly much loss. Verse 9 and 10, not only the perhaps loss of the cargo, but the ship, but also the possibility of our own lives, he says. Now, one of the things we want to note just here is that the Apostle Peter, or Apostle Paul, rather, was not only experienced on the Mediterranean Sea, but he knows what he's talking about. And we had some discussion about the reasoning that might take place between the centurion and the owner of the ship and the master, based on the deliverance of the cargo and the urgency of that and so forth and the other passengers. And so they want to get a little farther down the way. Now, we noted in our last study that travel from Fair Havens over to Phoenix, how far was that? I know looking on the map, it's hard to get a good estimation of how far that was. But anyone remember how far it was? Was only about 40 miles. Now, I say that as if that's nothing. It was only about 40 miles. We might reason that way by ship or by car or by any kind of modern-day travel. So that's not very far. But the travel during this time of year by way of a ship, a sailing vessel, that could turn into quite a long distance. But they thought reasonably that, and I think so, that this would be a better place to winter. The text tells us that. One of the things that has caused some to raise questions about the location of Phoenix on our map has to do with the topography, modern topography of that end of the Isle of Crete. One of the things that we've noted is that historically there was an earthquake. I don't recall the exact year that it took place, but it changed the topography of the land somewhat. But what we want to note in our study is that there was a place that ships could come into from this direction and from this direction that would somewhat protect them from the winds. And it provided a good place for them to spend the winter. And so that was where these fellows intend to go. But when they set sail, attempting to go in that direction, in verse 14 it tells us, but after no long time, they're beat down from it, a tempestuous wind, which is called Heraclea. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven. Now, interestingly enough, when they gave way to the wind, they essentially take down the sails and let the wind take them where that it will. Because controlling the ship is just very difficult, by understanding this. And I wish Richard was here, because he spent a good bit of time in the Navy and well familiar with that kind of thing. Some of you perhaps have had some experience along that line. But what we want to note here is that they were running under the lee of a small island called Cauda and were able with difficulty to secure the boat. Now, what I understand about the boat is perhaps even a lifeboat. Now, from some material that I've read on this subject, they said that a lifeboat was often, during this time, a much smaller vessel that was pulled behind the main ship. But now, when the winds were blowing and the sea was tempestuous, you don't want that small boat back there just flopping around. So the idea was to secure it, and they would hoist it up, much like I would suppose some of our sailing vessels today that have lifeboats on them. They don't just tug along behind them. They hoist them up into secured locations, and that's what my understanding is of this passage. But it was with difficulty they were able to do that. Now, in verse 17, when they had hoisted it up, they used helps undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should be cast upon Syrtis, they lowered the gear and were so driven. Two things I want us to see in that. When they secured the lifeboat, they used undergirding, which I understand is a common occurrence, especially with wooden vessels, to put cables underneath the ship. We talked about that last time. Essentially, to tie the boat together. Now, I've never been on the ocean, so I don't know anything about storms on the ocean. I certainly don't think that this would be appealing to me, to be on a wooden ship and to have to band it together with cables just to keep it from tearing apart.
from the waves. But that's what they did. Now, the text also tells us that they feared lest they should be cast upon Syrtis. Now, my understanding of that is that it was an extensive sandbank to the north of Africa, and it's still there and still known as a very treacherous place for travel. So the winds driving you onto that kind of a sandbank with the storm, it would certainly put the ship in peril. So they didn't want to do that. So they lowered the gear and were driven. Now, Richard raised an interesting question after class was over. I had it in my notes, but we didn't talk about it because we were running out of time. But it tells us that they lowered the gear. Two elements involved in that. One is, and I think I have a chart somewhere on that, when they lowered the gear, two thoughts on that. One is that the gear was to lower the sails that they could live without, to take all the equipment of the ship and fix it where the wind would not drive the ship. Another idea that Richard pointed out was that sometimes they would lower what was called a drifting anchor that was shaped kind of like a cone. We often think of an anchor in sailing vessels today. We have anchors that they throw down, give a big hook and all that. And we've seen some of them. If you've ever been to the Queen Mary, you see the huge, huge anchors. But the anchors that I understand were used here were something that would simply slow the ship down. It wasn't something that would tie it to the bottom, but it was kind of a cone-shaped thing that they would cast out to slow the ship down so that the winds would not drive it so forcefully. And several sources give us, I think, that information. But either one of these, I think, would help us to see that what they're trying to do is experienced sailors. They're trying to secure the ship to keep it from disaster. In verse 18 it says, "And as we labored exceedingly with the storm, the next day they began to throw the freight overboard." Now later we learn what the freight was. It was wheat. And as they were throwing the freight overboard, when you consider the size of this ship, my understanding was that it had a cargo area that would hold in the neighborhood of 10 to 11 tons. How would you like to have the responsibility of throwing all of that out? And with the waves and winds like they are, and to think of all of that getting wet, and now it's your job to throw all that stuff out so that you can make the ship have greater buoyancy and hopefully preserve the ship and, more importantly, preserve your life. And so this is what they were doing. They threw the freight overboard. And then on the third day, they cast out with their own hands the tackling of the ship. Some of you might have a footnote in your Bible that says furniture. I'm sure they're not talking about the captain's desk and things of that nature, just particularly. But anything that wasn't essential to the operating of the ship was thrown overboard, again, to try to lighten the ship and secure it and to save their lives. Now, in verse 20, "And when neither sun nor stars shone upon us for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was now taken away." Two things I want us to see in that. Neither sun nor stars had shone for many days. How do you navigate a ship? Well, we would say today, well, we've got computer, we've got GPS. They didn't have that. How did they navigate the ship, Bruce?
Well,
they would move. Well, yeah, the stars. You see, they would navigate the ship with the stars. Now, if you're out in the ocean, it's day, it's night, it's day, it's night, and you can't see the stars. You can't see the sun. You can't see the moon. You don't know where you are, and the ship is just taking, or the wind's just taking the ship here and there and here and there. And then in the next verse, it tells us that when they had been long without food, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and has somewhat to say to them. Now, many days have taken place like this. They've neither seen the sun nor the star. They don't know where they are. They don't know what direction that they're going in. And
as Richard indicated, having been on a ship during tempestuous seas, you might go a long time without eating for a variety of reasons. It might be because you're anxious. It might be because you can't keep any food down. And it might be because the food's contaminated. I mean, you can speculate for quite a little while, but the fact is given. They've gone for several days and hadn't eaten anything. Now, I've never been on a vessel, but I've gone several days and didn't want to eat anything. You know what happens to you when you don't eat anything for a long time? You get weak, just really, really weak. And Paul's concerned about them because he knows some things they don't know. Paul knows that he's going to Rome, and he's going to tell them in just a moment that an angel of the Lord stood by him and told him what was going to be, and that there would not be any loss of life, and they need to eat because they're going to need their strength. Now, you can sit on the ship and not eat because you're sick, but eventually you're going to need to eat if you're ever going to get off the ship. And Paul's telling them that. And what we want to note is, in verse 21, he said, "You ought to listen to me. While we were back there in Crete, I tried to tell you, this is not the time of year to sail." And they wouldn't listen. Now, one of the things that I want to note just here is Paul is not trying to sound egotistical or arrogant. He's just speaking from the standpoint of experience. He's been on this sea before. He knows what it's capable of, and the rule of thumb is you don't sail during this time of year for this very reason. And so that's why he had reminded them of that back when they were at Fair Havens. But now he said in verse 22, "Be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, whose I am, whom also I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, for thou must stand before Caesar. And lo, God hath granted thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it hath been spoken unto me." Now let's pause right there. I ask you to, and Lynn, thank you for helping me to remember. When I noticed this, I thought, that's what I asked you to do. Lynn asked me Wednesday night, I guess it was, what it was that I had asked the class to do. I'd asked a question, and at the moment I just could not recall what it was. But the question is, why does Paul have any reason to have confidence that everything is going to be okay? That is, that there's not going to be any loss of life, because he emphasizes that. "Sirs, I believe God that it shall be even as it hath been spoken unto me." Why did Paul have reason to believe God? Now, we might speculate, but I'm looking for evidence. What is it that Paul has already experienced that would cause him to know that they're going to reach Rome?
Well, in Acts 23:11, God tells him that he's going to go to Rome.
That's exactly right. He's been told that you're going to Rome, Acts 23, verse 11. Now, interestingly enough, if we'll turn back just a little bit, the Lord had appeared to Paul at least three times, and we want to make note of that. We can read in Acts chapter 9, Acts 22, and Acts 26, the first appearance of the Lord after the resurrection unto Saul of Tarsus, where Saul raised the question, "Who art thou, Lord?" And you're familiar with that. And the Lord said, "I am Jesus, the Nazarene, whom thou persecutest." And that's recorded for us those three times. But there's another time when the Lord appeared to Saul. And we want to note that in Paul's account to the people, the Jews, there in the city of Jerusalem, as he makes his defense in Acts 22, beginning in verse 17. Now, this was independent of the events of his conversion, or independent of the events, rather, of the Lord appearing to him just prior to his conversion. In verse 17, it tells us of Acts 22, "And it came to pass that when I had returned to Jerusalem, and while I prayed in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying unto me, Make haste and get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, because they will not receive of thee testimony concerning me. And I said, Lord, they themselves know that I am imprisoned and beaten in every synagogue, them that believe on thee. And when the blood of Stephen, thy witness, was shed, I also was standing by and consenting and keeping the garments of them
that slew me. And he said unto me, depart, for I will send thee forth far unto the Gentiles. Now, that's independent of the events before he arrived at Damascus, where Ananias asked him, why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized. So we want to note these three occasions when the Lord had appeared to him. Had what the Lord said to Saul proven to be so every single time? Oh, absolutely. And so consequently, what we know is when the Lord appeared to him on this ship and said, or an angel of the Lord, and said, you're going to make it, everything's going to be fine. What we want to know is Paul has reason to believe that what the Lord says is so. Now, don't underestimate that. I believe God. That was not just some kind of a supposition. Paul has every confidence because of evidence to trust what God has revealed to him by this angel. Now, you might say, well, if an angel told me something, I'd believe it too. That's not the point. The point is, based on evidence, Paul said, I believe God. And we want to take that part home with us, brethren. When you read it in the text, you know that's so. You can have confidence in that. God doesn't call upon us to believe things just as if it's a myth. He provides us with evidence so we can have confidence that what he says is so. Now, we could go a long way elaborating on that, but I think you see the point. We can talk about the substance of our hope from Hebrews chapter 11, beginning in verse 1, and identify what faith is, how that it involves trust. And that trust is founded upon what God has said. Not some kind of a feeling or some kind of a myth, but based on the things that we know to be true. That it shall be even so as it hath been spoken unto me. Comment or question just here.
So just what he believed was not that it was going to be an easy process to get there.
No.
He believed how the New American Standard reads that it will turn out as it's been sown. Again, his faith was in how it was going to turn out, how it was going to end, what the conclusion of the matter was. And that's what he held on to. And he, you know, there was no promise that it was going to be an easy journey there.
Oh, no. No, it's going to be with difficulty. This journey had been with difficulty up to this point. It's going to continue to be so. But be of good cheer. There won't be any loss of life, only the ship. And we know that's so. That's what God said. Now, in verse 26, he said, but we must be cast upon a certain island. Now, that's interesting to me. Because when you think about where they are, well, we might raise the question and say, well, they didn't know where they were. That's true. And I've seen maps that have depicted this, and they show just a jagged line. Well, we don't know. But the point is, they're lost in this storm. But Paul knows we're going to be cast upon a certain island. And when you look in the area, you see that the island that we have on the map is a very small island. But Paul knows that they're going to be shipwrecked. It's not going to be an easy thing to survive this. Now, in verse 27, it said, but when the 14th night was come, as we were driven to and fro. Now, some translations you're reading from might say up and down, and I guess that's probably the reason why some have put a jagged line in this portion of the Adrian Sea. But it tells us about midnight, the sailors surmised that they were drawing near to some country. Now, that's interesting to me as well. I'm not a sailor. Never been on the ocean before in my life. But I've read some about this place and where they were shipwrecked. And I understand that sailors even today know that there is a rocky shore along here that makes a lot of noise when you get close to it. And you might say, well, the storm, wouldn't that make a lot of noise? Well, yes. But to me, when I go over to the coast and I hear the waves breaking, to me that's a lot of noise. We might say, well, that's pleasant. But now, if you're a sailor and you're hearing the waters breaking on the rocks, that would not be pleasant. And so they know that something is not good. They surmise that they were drawing near to some country. And they sounded and found 20 fathoms. And after a little space, they sounded again and found 15 fathoms. Now, again, I'm not a sailor, but I understand that a fathom is about 6 feet. From what I've studied, they say that it's about fingertip to fingertip. Well, now you see that would be different on the size of the fellow, but it would be about 6 feet. And so, from what I understand, the 20 fathoms would be in the neighborhood of 120 feet. Now, if they are surmising that they're drawing near some country, the idea is they're getting close to land. And in the tempestuous sea, aware that some of these places have rocky shorelines, and you're coming close, you want to know how deep you are, how deep the water is. And so they would sound. Now, what I understand that simply to mean is they'd throw out a line. We do that all the time, do we not? Those of you who have any experience at construction, don't you take a chalk line and plumb and maybe measure the distance from point A to point B? They would take a strand, put a weight on it, throw it in the ocean, pull it up, see where the water line is, get an estimate or an estimate of how deep the water is. Now, if it's 120 feet deep, and you wait a little while and you throw out the line again, and it's 90 feet, what are you learning? It's getting shallower and shallower and shallower, and so what have you figured out? You sense that you're close to land. You don't know if it's rocky shore or not, but you do know that you're getting ready to hit something, and you don't want to do that if you can avoid it. It says, in fearing, verse 29, lest haply we should be cast ashore on rocky ground, they let go anchors from the stern. Now, those of you who are more acquainted with boats than I am, what end is the stern? It's the rear part. It's the rear part from what I've read. Now, some of you others may know more about that than I do, but I understand that's the rear of the ship. And they wished for day. Now, why would you do that? It tells us they let go four anchors from the stern and wished for the day. If you don't, and again, this is all based on things that I've read, not my experience, but my understanding is that if the winds are taking you in that direction and you throw out anchors, the idea is to keep the ship pointed with the wind instead of broadside to the wind, because that way you stand a better chance against the waves, because the waves hitting broadside could destroy the ship. And so they cast out anchors and wish for day where they could see. And knowing that they're about to hit something, at least perhaps in the daylight, they could see what it was. So they wished for day. Now, in verse 30, and as the sailors were seeking to flee out of the ship and had lowered the boat. Now, what boat would that be? The one we read about a while ago, the one that had been secured, the one that had been brought up into its secure place on the ship, the lifeboat. They began to lower the boat. Now, that draws a picture in your mind, does it not? You've seen the movie Titanic, and no doubt the concern of the lifeboats. Lower the boats. That's what they're doing. And Paul tells them that's not a good idea. Now, why do they lower the boats? Text tells us, verse 30, says under the color. That's interesting terminology. Some of you may have a different translation. Verse 30. Under the color, as though they would lay out anchors from the foreship. That would be the bow. So they're lowering what appears to be the lifeboat under the pretense of we're going to set out more anchors. Well, did they have to lower a lifeboat to set out anchors in the rear? No, but now they're thinking we've got to lower the lifeboat to set out anchors in the front. No. No, what are they attempting to do? They're trying to flee. That's right. And Paul just point blank tells them in verse 31. He said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. Now that's interesting to me. If folks try to get away in the lifeboats, then that's going to jeopardize everything. And it tells us then that the soldiers cut away the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. They don't flip the switch and let the gears go down and everything. No, they just cut the rope. And soldiers would be so equipped to do that. They cut the rope and let the lifeboat fall. And then in verse 33, "And while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take some food, saying, This day is the 14th day that ye wait and continue fasting, having taken nothing." Now, we mentioned a moment ago there might be all kinds of reasons for not eating, but there's some food, obviously, that is available to them. And Paul desires that they would eat. I can't imagine what it would be. Well, maybe I can imagine going that lengthy period of time and not eating. But the point being is they need nourishment. And he's telling them that. You need to eat because you're going to need your strength. You've taken nothing. So he beseeches them to take some food, he said, "for this is for your safety. For there shall not a hair perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said this and had taken bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all. And he broke it and began to eat. Several things that we might want to note just here. He's telling them, you're going to be fine. You'll not perish. Not a hair of your head is going to perish. But in this storm, and with the ship about to break apart and all these calamities occurring, he thanks God. Now, question. You think you could find anything to be thankful for on such an occasion? Sometimes we get to looking in our own lives and we suffer some kind of tragedy or calamity, and we search and search and search. We think in vain to find anything to be thankful for. But here, their lives may very well be in jeopardy. At least certainly it appeared so to some of them. But Paul is thankful. Thankful for what? Pardon me? Well, that they're okay. And what about the food that they're about to eat? They have food. And without which they would not have strength for their own safety. There is a lot to be thankful for, even during the most tempestuous of seas. And we want to note that. He's thankful for their food, even though they are under some very difficult times. And it says that he did that in the presence of all. And he broke it and began to eat. You know, sometimes folks need to be led to do the things that are right. Paul has already told them, you're going to be fine. God has told me by an angel that we'll lose the ship, we'll lose the cargo, we'll lose everything, but we won't lose our lives. And now he tells them, eat, because everything's going to be fine. But it's Paul that took the food and began to eat. And then it tells us, then were they all of good cheer, and themselves also took food. Paul has led them to believe what he's told them by his own example. He's helping them to see just exactly what they need to be doing. And I call your attention in particular, we mentioned this earlier, that there were 276 people on board that ship. And you might think that with the tempestuous nature of the sea during this time, and the distance that they're traveling, trying to get to Rome, and all that sort of thing, that it would be impossible for that many people to be on board this ship. Now, what did we note about cargo ships during this time? Was it just simply for the deliverance of the cargo? No. If you wanted to travel from point A to point B, you're not going to find a Caribbean cruise liner that's going to take you to where you want to go. So you find a freight liner that's going to take you. And so there were passengers on board this ship, not just the soldiers who were responsible for the deliverance of these prisoners, and not just the sailors who were responsible for the conducting of the ship. There's people on here that's simply traveling from point A to point B. They're trying to get to Rome too. And 276 people on this ship. Now, when it tells us that they all began to eat, that in itself ought to tell you that there is a substantial amount of food on board this ship. Whether they feel like eating it or not, they're eating. Because Paul has told them it's for your safety, you need to eat. And then in verse 38, it says, "And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea." They're getting rid of everything to save their own lives. So lightening this ship was no easy task. Now, he tells them that you need to eat for your safety. Now, Chris has made the point, a very valid point, that the things they're going to need to do in order to live is not going to be easy. There's going to be some work involved in this, which typically emergency circumstances do require somebody to work and to work hard. And you need strength during that time. And so Paul is telling them, you need to eat. There's work to be done. And it says, casting off the anchors. I'm sorry, verse 39. And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they perceived a certain bay with a beach, and they took counsel whether they could drive the ship up on it. Have you ever been in a circumstance that was very, very dire, and it appeared that you had one shot to make it good? You've got one chance to make this thing work. Now, if you don't take advantage of that one chance and do it right the first time, they're not going to be a second time. That's where they are. They've got one chance to make this work. There's rocks. There's a beach. A sandy beach. And the idea is to get rid of the anchors, verse 40, and try to drive the ship into the beach. Now, what's the purpose of that?
Hitting the rocks.
Right, you don't want to hit the rocks. Yeah, and if you can drive it hard into the beach, then you have a better chance of survival. And so the text tells us that they took counsel whether they could do that. We've got one chance to make this right, and so we've got to get it right. Now, verse 40, and casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea. At the same time, loosing the bands of the rudder and hoisting up the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. Hoisting up the foresail. What is their intent from the reading of this text? What are they attempting to do?
Shove
the front of the boat right into the beach. That's right. And the text tells us then in verse 41, but lighting upon a place where two seas meet, they ran the vessel aground, and the foreship struck and remained unmovable, but the stern began to break up by the violence of the waves. Now, it don't take a Solomon to see what's happening here. They've been successful in running the ship aground. The front is stuck, but where's the rear of the ship? Where these two seas come together. And with the storm, what's happening to the back end of the ship? It's just beating it to death. Tearing the ship into. Twisting it one way and then the other. And the ship begins to break. Now in verse 42, the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. Note why. We've studied this before. Why are the soldiers that are responsible for the prisoners so concerned about anybody getting away? That's right. If they let the prisoners escape, they pay with their life. So they reason, best kill the prisoners rather than to allow anyone to escape. And the centurion desiring to save Paul. The centurion's name was Julius. Desiring to save Paul, saved them from their purpose and commanded that they who could swim should cast themselves overboard and get first to the land. That's interesting to me, the order in which the centurion is now taking some control of this shipwreck. Desiring to save Paul, what have we learned about the centurion and Paul already?
He has a passion for him.
He has a passion for Paul, yes. We know that in Sidon, as we noted a few moments ago, he gave Paul leave to leave the ship and to go and refresh himself with his friends. We also might note that Paul's journey to Rome, and no doubt the centurion is aware of that, is not as a convicted criminal. What no doubt does this centurion know about Paul? What has been the judgment of Festus and Agrippa?
They couldn't find any reason.
Couldn't find any reason to condemn Paul, and if he had not made an appeal to go before Caesar, he could have been released. So Paul is not a dangerous criminal, and obviously Julius is aware of that. And so he has developed some kind of friendship with Paul over this period of time that they've been together. And so he desired to stay the soldiers from their purpose of killing all the prisoners. And then he commanded that they who could swim should cast themselves overboard and get first to the land. Now that's interesting to me for this reason. The centurion, he has control over the soldiers. No doubt when he commands that anybody that can swim get in the ocean and swim to shore. Who do you think is going to be the first to hit the water? Who does he command? The soldiers. Now, if the soldiers make it to the shore first, then what's going to happen when the prisoners get there?
They're still under the soldiers' control.
Well, that's right. That's right. So you get in the water and you swim. If you can swim, you get to the shore. And so the prisoners are not going to escape. But it tells us the rest, some on planks and some on other things from the ship. And so it came to pass that they all escaped safe to the land. The rest, that would be those that couldn't swim, or certainly those that couldn't swim well. They provided planks and things from the ship were their rescue. Now, having noted that, here's the shipwreck. Now, I've got this coming up on the screen. The thought goes right on into the 28th chapter, and it's unfortunate that we have a chapter division just here. But we'll stop with that, and I want you to look at our question sheets, and we'll just kind of introduce some of this because we won't have time to get very far with it. And those of you who are visiting with us, and those of you in the class as well, if you don't have a copy of the lesson sheet, I have those on the front pew up here. Some of you may have those in your previous notes. Some of you may have printed them off the internet. They're available on our website. If you'd like a copy of the lesson sheet on chapter 27, they're right up here, and Chris will get you those just to indicate your desire. All right, and you can have those. But as we use these, as always, we use those as a means of simple review. And this chapter, though very exciting, is a narrative of the events that took place. And what we will do, hopefully, in our time remaining, is have a period, have enough time to summarize these paragraphs that I've identified for you on the lesson sheet. Very briefly, summarize these paragraphs in chapter 27, verses 1 through 8. 1 through 8. Who has that for me? 1 through 8.
Well, just tell me about Paul's trip from when he gets on the ship to Fairhaven. It just tells about the different stops they made.
Well, that's right. And, of course, we've got two ships involved in this. Two, I guess you would call it, legs of the journey. At this point, one is the ship that he gets on initially from Caesarea, and then the ship that he gets on in Myra of Lycia, the ship that's coming from Alexander, and it's on its way then to Egypt, or to Rome. Alexandria, Egypt is where the ship originated. Okay, verses 9 through 26. Rather lengthy portion of the text here. 9 through 26. Bruce, what's in that portion of the text? 9 through 26. Mm-hmm. If you can summarize that, I know that's there's a lot of events that are discussed in those verses.
Well, you see that that Paul is wondering about the going on the journey. Going to Phoenix, and we see that that they don't listen, and he's telling about the shipwreck.
All right, essentially that's it. He's telling them what's about to happen and how that there would be no loss of life. I can't begin to imagine what it would be like to not only be in the sea for 2 weeks, but to be in a storm that lasts for 2 weeks. I know that when we lived back east in the Midwest there in Missouri and Arkansas, sometimes we would have storms that would follow another, but it wasn't like this. sometimes in the winter, in particular, we would have snowstorms. We kind of called it a blizzard. And I know that sounds weird for Arkansas and Missouri, because other places, blizzard is a lot worse than it was there. But during what was it, 78, I guess, the winter of 1978, we called that a blizzard because we had snow and ice, and it just kept coming, snow and ice, and it lasted for a long, long time. Temperature didn't rise very much above freezing. It lasted for nearly a month, I guess, during that time. But to be in the ocean and the sea bouncing you back and forth for 2 weeks, I can't begin to imagine what that would be like. Verses 27 through the end of the chapter, verse 44, what's in that? Well, that's the shipwreck, basically. So that's the shipwreck. So we'll leave it at that, and we'll pick up with these questions next time. So if you don't have a copy of them, make it known. We'll get you a copy. They're on the front pew, or pick one up, and we'll start with that next time. Please read, if you will, Acts chapter 28 for our next study. Acts chapter 28. And I've got some thoughts in mind of where we're going when we finish the book of Acts. So if you'd like to talk with me a little bit about that, I'd be happy to consider your thoughts on that.